Good evening, everyone. Welcome to this week's edition of Through the Keyhole. I'm your host, Karen Dolan, coming to you live from Rochester, New York. Thanks for joining me today on the Paranormal Radio Network. You can also hear us on UPRN 105.3 FM in New Orleans, or on your cell phone by typing P-A-R-A, then 27627. For more information on Through the Keyhole and on my guests, visit our website at www.keyholepublishing.com. And as always, I want to hear from you during the show. If you're listening live, join us on the message board to discuss the programs, and you can add your questions and comments. Go to paranormalradionetwork.org to join us in the virtual auditorium. You can participate in the conversation there through instant messaging. If you prefer, you can always email me with your questions and comments at kdolan@rochester.rr.com. Or you can call into the show toll-free at 1-877-786-0562. And all of this contact information is also available on the website at keyholepublishing.com. My guest this evening is Tim Binall of Binall of America Radio and Website. Some of you, I'm sure, have heard of him. He's the founder of the esoteric think tank, Binall of America, and I love that name because there are days when I just want to bin all of America, too. And I'm sure you were thinking of that when you set that up, right, Tim?
Oh, yeah, right.
Okay. I heard about this for, like, months, and all of a sudden one day I went, oh, my God, Bin all of America. That is so cool. I love that.
Well, I just lucked out because that's my name, so.
Yeah. It was just, I felt like an idiot because it took me, like, 6 months to catch on to that, so.
Well, if I had it to do all over again, I probably would have made it something more esoteric, but the website started out as sort of a personal thing, almost like a blog, so it was just Binall of America, sort of like a fun personal website, and then it became the esoteric think tank that it is now, so it sort of grew in the name, got stuck with it.
Well, it's a good one. I mean, I kind of fell into this Through the Keyhole thing, too. Rich came up with that when he used to write a column for one of the news, Phenomenon magazine.
Nice. Well, hey, thanks for having me on the show. I should do the hello and all that good stuff, and give a shout-out to all the folks down in New Orleans. Thanks for listening to the program. It's great to be on Through the Keyhole.
Well, thanks. It's great to have you. And I really enjoyed being on yours a while ago. I can't believe I didn't have you on Through the Keyhole sooner than this.
Oh, it's quite all right.
I really don't
do too many interviews. I only do maybe one every, like, 3 or 4 or 5 months or something like that, so I'm not a big media person myself.
Yeah. Now, I didn't realize that. You spend so much time doing your show, I guess. Now, you do yours all ahead of time, too, don't you?
Yeah, what we do is we're a seasonal format, so we run from September to June, and we kind of try to structure it more like a TV show where, we make a big to-do out of the season premiere. Every year we have a big Christmas special or holiday special with Stan Friedman. We're going to be adding in sort of a new thematic end-of-the-year special, too, this year. And then we wrap it up in June or so, right around the beginning of the summer, with a big season finale. And this past year, we closed out season 3 with an ultra-rare interview with Jacques Vallée that closed the book on season 3. And then I pretty much kicked off my shoes and relaxed for the summer and started taping interviews at the beginning of September. And we'll be rolling out season 4 next weekend, October 19th, at Binall of America and all the great affiliates that run us, like the Black Vault Network and Anomaly Radio Network.
Wow, I don't think I've heard of any of these other paranormal radio programs that are run as if it's on a TV schedule. That's really interesting that you do that.
Yeah, well, what I wanted to do was, the whole thing actually kind of goes back to, and I don't think I've ever told this story, but it's kind of funny, and I always give them a hard time about it, but when we first started out, it was just me and another guy named Joe V, who I went to high school with, who used to write for Binall of America. He doesn't anymore. He's got a life going on now outside of paranormal, so real world calls. And I had done some on-site interviews at the X conference in 2005, I think, and those ran in the sort of late spring of 2005, and then I was like trying to figure out, because I wanted to do my own podcast, and this was like way back before the podcast boom of the last couple of years. Back then it seemed like there was maybe only 5 or 6 people doing podcasts, and I was trying to figure out what I was going to do, and was going to interview him, Joe V, to sort of just test out the phone equipment and stuff like that, and we had scheduled to do an interview like on a Saturday or something, and I called him and he wasn't even around, and we never ended up taping it. And then after that I was like, forget this, this scheduling thing's for the birds. I gotta just tape a bunch of these interviews first, and then I'll be able to sort of work it all out better that way, because if I have already a bunch taped, then I'm not always under the gun to tape next week's episode. So I mean, my hat goes off to people like you, and I'd say, you know, 95% of the other podcasters out there, paranormal podcasters, who go week to week. I couldn't do it. I kind of like the way that we do our show. It's sort of keeps me safe as far as, you know, we're not live or anything, so we have the advantage of being able to cut loose with the guests a little bit, you know, where they're not worried that they're that something they said is going to end up all over the internet, you know. So
yeah,
it's a little more laid back like that, and it always it lets me relax and sort of plan ahead for the show, you know. It's like, well, I got this topic and that topic and this topic, but what I really kind of need now is, you know, a cryptozoology guest. So let's find mm-hmm. someone like that so we can slip them in here week three. You know what I mean? So let
yeah.
me plan things out a little bit. Let me be a little more creative and sort of think about it, like you said, like putting together a TV show in a way.
Yeah, I kind of try to select guests that way. You know, there are times when I look back over who I've talked to in the last 3 or 4 weeks and think, okay, what have I not done? You know, if I've been really heavy on UFOs, maybe at one point I had like 4 solid weeks of different people from MUFON.
Yeah.
And I said, okay, I got to, you know, mix it up. I need to get a ghost hunter in here, or, you know, something different.
Exactly, yeah. Well, yeah, you got to, it's tough to, sometimes you just want to call the people that you already know that, because you just
right, and in my case, most of the people I know are ufologists.
Yeah,
because
exactly.
I know everybody through Rich.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I do find that. There are many, many times when I wish, and I'm sure that my producer also wishes, that I would get something ready ahead of time.
Well,
yeah. There
yeah.
are times when it gets to be like Friday morning, and I'm thinking, oh, I wonder who I'm going to talk to tonight.
Oh, I hear you. I totally hear you, yeah. I'm kind of on the opposite end of the spectrum, too, in a way, too, because like I said, we taped stuff, and we've been taping since September, so I probably got close to, like, 8 hours of material here sitting on my hard drive that still has to be edited and stuff like that. So it's like I've got all these guests, I've got all this material, and all I've got, like, the next 6 weeks of the program already taped and everything, but I still got to sit down and edit them and write the recaps, because we try to put a lot into the recaps and make them as detailed as possible. So, you know, if someone's doing a web search and they want to know about something really specific, chances are if we talked about it on the show, it's in the recap, and then they'll know. You know,
yeah, I've noticed
case
that.
In Australia or something like that. It'll get picked up on Google, and then they'll know that it's talked about in, you know, the episode with Bill Chalker or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah, your recaps are amazingly detailed.
Yeah,
I mean,
well, that's the,
nobody does as much as you do.
Yeah, that's the plus side of being pre-taped, in a sense, and having to go through and edit the episode afterwards. And, you know, I'll be the first to admit, being a host of a program is a learning process for me, and so I definitely, you know, there's still some mistakes or poor segues from the guest saying one thing and then me doing the next question. So a lot of that stuff gets left on the cutting room floor, and that gives me an opportunity to go through the episode after I've already taped it and give it a good listen to, and then just write the recaps as I'm doing the editing. So it's not, it looks like a lot of work, but really it's sort of just a natural result of sitting there and listening to the interview all over again and cleaning it up and making sure everything sounds great.
So how much preparation do you like to do ahead of time? I mean, do you really plan out a lot of your questions and do a lot of research on your guests, or you don't strike me as one of those who just gets somebody on the show and starts talking?
No, I'm a total control freak. So
yeah.
What I really want to do is, depending on the guest, if it's someone who's written a book, I almost 99% of the time absolutely read the book first. And usually if it's, there are instances like we had a guest on last year, Tom Shackman, talking about the Amish rite of passage from Springer. And, you know, for somebody like that, it was like one of the cool parts about having your own show. I was at the bookstore. I'd always been kind of interested in the Amish and from Springer, and I saw the book. And I was like, I'd like to read this book, but I'm so busy with my show and everything that there has to be, like, some means to an end here. So I, like, went home and emailed him, and he was down with doing an interview, so I went back to the bookstore, picked up the book, and read it. So that was one of those cool instances where it's like, wow, it's great that I have a radio show here because I can actually read a book and then talk to the author afterwards. But as far as general guests go, I always want to read the book first, If they don't have a book or if they have like a movie or a website, I try to read it as much as possible. And then for prep time, really, you know, 2 hours before the show starts, I just sort of hunker down and focus really hard on trying to come up with, you know, about a dozen talking points. Not so much questions, but just talking points.
Mm-hmm.
And then try and use those as much as possible in the interview. And in some instances, there's guests, you know, that'll, you know, use a half hour to answer the first question. And sometimes I have to sort of make the creative decision, I guess you could say, or the journalistic decision about, am I going to stay on this line of thinking here with what we're talking about with the first question, or are we going to go to the next point? You know, and usually I'll err on the second, on the latter part of that, you know, rhetorical question, because I want to get as much information as possible into the interview and cover as much different ground as possible. So sometimes, like when I'm doing an interview, it's sort of, you know, the guest will finish saying something and I'll just jump right into the next question, and that's just sort of like the decision that, you know, I got all these points and I want to make sure we get to as much of them as possible, because usually they're weird elements or unique parts of their work that I've noticed that I want to explore more. And you know, it's not like when the interview's over I can ask them the questions anyway, you know what I mean? So
right.
It's like usually there's something that's interesting to me and I want to talk about it with them, so and once the interview's over we may talk for like 5 minutes and then it'll be like, hey, thanks for coming on the show, see you later. So I want to make sure I ask them the stuff that interests me pretty much. But yeah, I do about 2 hours of prep work where I put together the questions and stuff like that, and of course read all the books and stuff and make a ton of notes. Like all the books of the previous guests who've been on the show are just like riddled with dog ear corners and star marks next to certain paragraphs and stuff. So when I'm doing the prep work, I usually open up the book and go to all those dog-eared things and read the starred parts and try and remember what had stuck out to me about that, and then put it together into a talking point.
Yeah, I always make sure, too, if somebody has a book, I make sure I've read it. But do you find that you kind of have to be careful also not to learn too much? I find that I like to leave some open so that I have something to ask about.
That's true, too, because like I had said, I did an interview with Adam Gorightly a while back on his show, and I kind of, the same sort of situation came up. We were talking about it, and it's weird, too, because when you read the book, you already know the information that you're asking them to sort of repeat for the audience who hasn't read the book.
Yeah.
So there are times when I've finished an interview and I was like, I really didn't, you know, that was a great interview. I really didn't like, and I enjoyed it, obviously, you know, whatever, but I didn't like learn anything new because I was asking them about points that were in their book that the audience hadn't heard about, but I already kind of knew about, and it was sort of like me and the guest had an inside joke here or an inside information and we were going to share it with the people, and it was like, it's kind of weird in a sense like that. And a lot
yeah.
of times, you know, maybe it better, but I couldn't imagine not reading the book, you
well,
know,
because yeah.
then I wouldn't know what to ask.
I worry sometimes, though, that, like, I'll know too much and I won't bring out something, some obvious question that a listener would have if they hadn't read it.
That's true, yeah. That's true. Well, usually, thankfully, most of the guests sort of add in that background part, because that's sort of another kind of element that you're talking about, where I'll ask a question and it'll be really specific, and the guest will sort of have to give the background to that and then get into the question. And but usually the guests are pretty cool about that, and they kind of understand that I've read the book, and, you know, I usually only have guests on that I enjoy their work of. You know, I've had very few guests on where I'm like, this book was kind of stinky. But
right.
I don't say that on the show, right? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But it's sort of like... So I encourage the people to pick up, you know, 90% of the books by the people that are on the show, you know. I mean, I've enjoyed almost all of them. So, I mean, that's the kind of thing, like, my attitude, too, is that, you know, the interview sort of serves a dual purpose. First, to showcase the guest and showcase their book and showcase their work. And second, to act as sort of an addendum to come back to after you've read the book. You know, like, I think a lot of the interviews, if you listen to them, they're great, they're awesome, you learn a lot of stuff, but if you went out and got the book and then read it and then listen to the
yeah.
interview afterwards, I think you'd pick up so much more, too, because then you'd be like, oh, wow, you know, that now I see what that guy's talking about. So
right, then
I
you
try
get
to,
a background on it.
Exactly. So, you know, we sort of serve a dual purpose.
Yeah, it is one of the most fun things about this job, as you mentioned, is being able to read a really cool book and think, oh, God, I'd love to talk to this person. You know what? You can.
Yeah.
You just call them up and invite them on your radio show.
Exactly,
yeah. I love that.
It's really cool. It's really cool. And I try to go out and branch out into some other stuff too, if I'm not like the Amish episode or a pro wrestling episode or the baseball one we had Rich on last spring. So, you know, try to do some outside the box type of stuff too to break up the monotony of the paranormal sometimes.
Yeah, Rich asked me to mention that baseball one this evening. I said he almost he practically handed me a prepared statement that he really wanted to point out how well he did. He was very pleased with his picks.
Yes, Rich did exceptionally well. He got 4 out of 8 and trounced the rest of the competition. I only got 1 out of 8 on the predictions, and but I got to warn Rich that Greg Bishop has, and I don't know how much of a baseball fan you are, so this may go over your head, but Greg Bishop has picks for the Red Sox and Dodgers to play in the World Series and for the Dodgers to win. So if that happens, then he'll pick up additional points. And so he may actually bump him out, because poor Rich had the Mets versus the Yankees in the World Series, and that's not going to happen.
Well, he's a Yankee fan from way back. So
I know, I know.
From he wanted to make the point, too, though. He said the ones he missed very, very closely. They're just really out. So.
Yeah, he was really on the bubble. He did really well, so I was very impressed. I thought I was in, like, the catbird seat, like, in the middle of July, and then all of a sudden, like, all the picks I had sort of fell by the wayside in September, and I was left with like 2 picks or something like that. But I was going to mention that I'm sort of breaking my own coda here because the Red Sox will be starting in about an hour, but I'll still be on the show here with you, so I'll be kind of keeping an eye on it in the corner of my eye, and then booting down to my buddy's place at 9. If I hang up the phone and run right out, but because it's crazy here this time
of
year.
Second hour.
What's that?
So you'll be a little distracted in the second hour, but...
Well, I keep the TV to my back when I'm doing the show, so usually it's not a problem.
Okay. So, Tim, what kind of guests do you usually have on Been All of America? I mean, when you were just talking about wanting to branch out and get some different kinds of topics in here. What do you normally do?
We normally do, your general paranormal milieu. UFOs, cryptozoology, those are sort of the big tenets of our show, and then some conspiracy stuff. And last year we sort of did a little more ghost related material, some alternative science. I'd say about 65% is UFOs, so it's definitely still the bulk of the show, and then a good 20% is cryptozoology, and then the other, I don't know, I'm not that great at math here on the fly, but the other 20-30% is all these other sort of topics, but definitely mostly UFOs. And we've sort of in the last year or so, we sort of have been sort of consciously trying to branch out into international ufology, because I don't think, I don't see too many international UFO guests on other shows and stuff, and I'll be the first to admit that I really don't follow too many other shows. I don't listen to any other podcasts, so
it's hard. I mean, there are a lot of really great shows, and it's hard to find the time, especially when you're working on your own.
Absolutely, yeah. It's hard to find the time, and then you find yourself, I don't want to get stuck in the situation where I'm comparing my show to other shows, or, I don't want to turn into a puppet or
something
like that.
Right, you don't want to start even inadvertently copying the shows that you're hearing or comparing yourself to somebody else's show when you're really two totally different kinds of hosts and different kinds of programs. But I could see myself becoming derivative without meaning to.
Yeah, exactly. So I mean, when I first started out, like I said, there was only like 5 or 6 shows out there, it seemed like, and I listened to those shows to sort of get an idea for what the scene was like. But then after maybe like the middle of season 2 or something, or the beginning of season 2, after we've been doing this for about a year and a half, then it just seemed like this whole internet podcasting thing exploded, and there was so many paranormal podcasts that I couldn't even keep up. So it was like, I don't want to really know what's going on a lot of the other shows, because I don't want to like get into a situation where they have a guest on and then I think, well, I can't have this guest on for like 6 weeks or something like that, or they have a guest on and I'm like, oh shit, I already taped,
I think we're okay with that
in New Orleans. I forgot we're on the regular radio too. What's that?
You're used to pre-recording.
Exactly.
See, you're live, Tim.
I know. Yeah, well, I forgot we're on regular radio too, so I apologize to all those great folks in New Orleans for the S-bomb, but yeah, I'll see someone else's schedule, and I'll be like, oh, gosh.
Willikers.
Yeah, they have the guest on, that I already taped like 2 weeks ago, and what am I going to do now? So I try not to worry about that too much, try not to look too much at other people's schedules and stuff like that, because I don't want to get caught up in that kind of thing, because the whole thing with podcasting is people can listen whenever they want, They can listen to as many shows as they want, you know. So they're really, I don't feel like there's some kind of like competition amongst shows.
Yeah, I had that happen myself just recently. Actually, I scheduled a guest, and then because of the storms down in New Orleans, we were not able to broadcast, so it had to be pushed off. And then it turned out another show on my network, on Paranormal Radio Network, had the same guest on. And I was supposed to be first. I think I was the first one to invite this guest, but I ended up being, I don't know, second or third one to interview him. And it was, I thought, oh, darn it, you know, I was going to do that.
Yeah, then you're
but
like,
it worked
should
out
I listen?
Well, because the other hosts who interviewed this man all had very different outlooks. We all came at the same topic from different angles. So actually, it was really good that we all did the interviews around the same time.
Nice. Yeah, so yeah, more international UFO stuff. That's sort of what we kind of got into last year, and do maybe try to do one new international ufologist like every 6 weeks. Last year we did Christo Lowe in South Africa, Gildas Bourdais in France, and Bill Chalker in Australia, and I guess technically Nick Pope in the UK. So those are sort of like the international UFO guests we did last year. And this year, I might as well sort of like break some news, I guess, for the show here.
Well, I was going to ask you what you've got coming up for this season. So
yeah, for sure. Yeah. Well, I'll just start and say that on the topic of the international UFO guests, we're going to have Neil Gould from Hong Kong on the program here for season 4. We already taped the episode. We're going to be talking about Hong Kong ufology and Chinese ufology, and just a fascinating look at what it's really like over there across the world, really, 12 hours away. It was quite an interview to do and schedule and stuff like that, and it was really fascinating because there's a whole different culture over there in Hong Kong and China. And then Neil's living over there in Hong Kong, so, you know, he's got a great perspective on what it's really like, and he's part of the Hong Kong exopolitics movement, so we sort of have some exopolitics in there. And, you know, we all know about exopolitics here in America and what's going on with that, but it's like a whole different scene and story over there in Hong Kong. You don't want to rattle the cage too much over there. That's the impression I got from Neil, but you'll hear all about it, I guess, when he's on the show in a few weeks.
Oh, I'm not going to want to miss that one. Now, I know at the X conference last year, speaking of exopolitics, there were a lot of people who were talking about setting up exopolitics groups in other countries. I mean, we met people from Ireland and Denmark and Germany who were all, you know, going to go home and set up their exopolitics websites there. So
yeah.
It's really this huge thing. But I hadn't heard anything about China. That's pretty exciting.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. I think Neil's doing a lot of great work over there, so it was pretty interesting, because from what I understand and what from he said in the interview, and like I said, folks can hear it in a few weeks on Banal of America, but he said sort of the culture over there is like people don't want to really report UFO sightings and stuff like that, so it's very sort of under the radar. So it was pretty interesting, I found.
Well, do you think that's very different from here? I mean, a lot of people in this country don't want to report it. Sightings either.
Yeah, but from that was kind of the impression I got, and then from what I got from him, it was sort of like it's the situation where there's not even that many famous, there's not even any famous cases prior to, like, you know, the late 90s or something.
Oh, wow.
It's like that non-reporting of UFOs.
Okay, that's intense.
Yeah, so that was the impression I got, but I think that'll be coming up sometime in the beginning of November, probably the 1st, the 8th, or the 15th, one of those first three Saturdays in November.
So whenever you feel like putting it up, right?
Pretty much, yeah. Yeah, well, I haven't really, like I said, I got the next 6 weeks' worth of episodes, and I know for sure that the October 19th will be Jim Mars, because we always kick off the season with Jim Mars. And I also know that the fifth episode of the season will be our 100th episode in the seasonal format. So we have a very special superstar A-list name. I'm not going to reveal it just yet, but I've already taped it, and it's going to be a big one. So that'll be in 5 weeks from, I don't know, the 19th. So 1, 2, 3, 4, the 16th of November will be the 100th episode with a big name.
So your show airs on the 16th on Sundays. Does
generally.
It come out every Sunday, or?
If it doesn't come out on Saturday, it'll be out on Sunday. That's sort of that's sort of the policy here at the headquarters. It all depends really on what's going on with me on Saturday, and if I have time to tape those little intro parts that I really don't like doing at all, so that it seems like if I'm not in the mood to tape them, they always take longer than they should. So if I'm kind of feeling laid back and everything's going okay, I can bang them out, you know, in 20 minutes or something. But if it doesn't go off right the first time around, chances are it's going to take me 4 or 5 hours because, you know, I'll listen to them again, you know, not straight, you know. I'll try and tape one, and I'll be so disappointed with how I thought it turned out that, you know, I'll go do something else for an hour, and then I'll come back and be like, oh, let's try this again. So it's very frustrating. I wish I could come up with a more seamless way of doing it. But maybe now that I've taken the last 3 months off, it'll be a little more smoother because every year it seems to be a little easier for me to do that. Being able to go back and listen to the intro is kind of like a nightmare because you always have the opportunity to edit it, or, you know, you're like, oh, I don't like the inflection of my voice here, and little things that really in the back of your mind, you know, the audience isn't going to rewind and listen to. It's just going to go right past them. So, but in my mind, it's like, I didn't like the way I said this, so I'm going to retape this whole thing. And it's like, oh, stop beating yourself up over this. But, you know, those are the trials and tribulations of a pre-taped show, I guess.
Well, right, as you're talking, I was just thinking, boy, that's a good thing and a bad thing about doing the live show. I mean, when I do mine live, like right now, if I'm hesitating, you hear that, and it's out, and I can't change it. But on the other hand, I don't have to worry about going back and changing it because it's done. It's out.
Exactly. So it's a catch-22, you know. You have the advantage of being able to edit it, but then you also have the disadvantage of feeling responsible that you should edit or something. So it's kind of a nightmare at times. But yeah, we used to be pretty consistently on Saturdays, and then sort of last year we sort of segued into putting the show out on Sunday afternoons or so and posting the preview for the show on Saturdays. Because what we do up in All of America, I should also definitely want to point out the awesome BOA staff, the folks who write for the website. We're not just a podcast. We also we just run the podcast on the weekends, and then Mondays through Fridays it's written columns from great folks who are friends of BOA and who write for the website. And that's Leslie Chiron, Regan Lee, Tina Senna, Rochelle Hawks, and Richard Thomas from Wales. I'm sure a lot of folks have heard of some of these guys who write for the BOA. Leslie's got the great website Debris Field. Regan has just a myriad of websites. Women in Esoterica, I think, is her main hub. Mm-hmm. And Rochelle Hawks writes for a lot of websites and stuff like that, too. So, you know, they're pretty established writers, and they're out there. And then they write for Banal of America, you know, Mondays through Fridays. So we used to have an open slot kind of on Fridays where we didn't really post anything, and that was when we did the previews. And then we put the episode out on Saturdays, but then we filled the Friday slot with Rochelle and Richard Thomas. So now, to sort of give them the spotlight on Fridays and make their columns stand alone, we move the previews to the shows on Saturdays and sort of bump the show up to Sunday. So I figure that'd probably be where we stay for season four.
Cool. So when does season four actually begin?
Season four begins next Sunday, October 19th, at Banal of America, and then I'm not sure how long it takes for them to get picked up on the Anomaly Radio Network and Black Vault, but shortly afterwards on those. But just go to Banal of America, BINNALL of America.com, and you'll be able to find this little countdown there on the website right now, counting down to October 19th, which is when we roll out season four with Jim Morris.
Cool. So is Jim going to be talking about his new book?
Totally. We're going to be really delving into it. I read the whole book like the week before we had him on the show, so it was really fresh in my mind. And we talk about a lot of crazy stuff that was in Rise of the Fourth Reich, and some weird stuff that sort of stuck out to me, kind of like I was saying earlier, little points that stood out. Maybe they were only like a mention on a page or something like that, but it was like, whoa, I got to expand on this. And one thing definitely that I wanted to mention that we're going to be talking about is the assassination attempt of Jimmy Carter that a lot of people have never even heard of. I had never heard about it, but it's in Rise of the Fourth Reich. And
I hadn't heard about that.
Yep, well, you're going to hear about it on October 19th on Banal of America Audio Season 4 because I made sure to ask Jim about this, and we talked for a while about that. And, you know, sort of every year we have Jim on to kick off the season, so towards the end of the episode we probably spend a good 20 minutes, you know, talking about the past year since he's been on, and where he sees the sort of the state of affairs for 9/11 research and UFO research and stuff like that, because it's always cool to hear what he's thought about what's been going on the last year.
Yeah, he's always really into the most cutting-edge research.
Oh, Jim's the best. I mean, I never understand some of these people that you know, want to criticize some of the stuff he's done. I don't get it, you know. Everybody has critics, it seems, on the Internet.
Yeah.
But, you know, he's the best. He's definitely someone that I look up to and want to be like. And the fact that he can speak intelligently and coherently and in-depth on 9/11 UFOs, the JFK assassination, remote viewing, I mean, those are huge subjects that, you know, you talk to some ufologists and they wouldn't even know anything about the 9/11 thing, or they don't even want to talk about it. With the obvious exception of Rich, who's done a great job talking about both subjects. Or if you talk to, like, 9/11 researchers, they don't, you know anything or want to talk about UFOs. So with somebody like Jim, he can talk about all sorts of different subjects and tie them in together. Because I think, ultimately, all this stuff probably comes down to, you know, the same thing. It's probably all somehow related in some sense. We won't really understand ever.
Yeah. Well, if nothing else, it's all related in that it's all stuff that someone's trying to keep down.
Exactly. It's,
you know,
all
someone's
about
making an effort to keep all of it hidden, which just makes me want to go start digging.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
I guess that's why we're all in this field. We're all the kind of people who just, you see someone keeping a secret and you want to know what it is.
Totally. Yeah. So I'm looking here. I got the preview up already. Well, it's not up at Banal of America, but it's been written already, the recap of the interview, because I have edited the Jim Mars one. And we're going to be talking about Rudolf Hess and his infamous flight to England during World War II and what really may have been going on with that. We're going to talk about secret space programs and how the Russians and the Americans all cherry-picked German scientists, and maybe that the German scientists were really working together. Infamous Nazi super soldier Otto Skorzeny we're going to be talking about. Social trends that were popular in Nazi Germany that are popular now in America, which are like vegetarianism and gun control and environmentalism, anti-smoking laws, all that stuff was really popular in Germany during the Nazi era, and now all of a sudden in the last few years has become really popular here in America. So that sort of is the whole Fourth Reich idea. So all those topics we're going to be delving into on the season premiere of BOA Audio Season 4.
That sounds like quite a kickoff.
It's going to be good. I usually have a great time talking to Jim because, like I said, he's. If it wasn't for him, you know, I wasn't even into this paranormal thing until I stumbled across a copy of Rule by Secrecy and read that and then got into the whole paranormal scene. So if it wasn't for Jim, there wouldn't even be a Banal of America. So he's sort of like, you know, a mentor in a way to me.
Wow. You know, I wanted to ask you, actually, how you got started doing your radio show. And, no, you just said that it was after you read this show or this book by Jim Mars. Now, how did that translate into a website and a podcast?
Oh, it's been quite a journey, to tell you the truth. And I always try to distill the bio, but every time I do this, it like it's more longer. But
yeah,
it sort of started out, like I said, the website was sort of just like a little a blog before blogs were around for me, for Tim Banal. So, that's why it was Banal of America. And then,
like you read Mars' book and just started writing your thoughts that came up after you read it?
Not necessarily about Jim stuff,
okay.
But just like, what happened was I read the Jim Mars book in like October, and then around December someone clued me into Coast to Coast, and I had been working the night shift anyway, so then all of a sudden I was getting like four hours of paranormal information every night for five nights a week pretty much at work. Mm-hmm. And got really into the scene pretty much from there, and then I was writing about Coast to Coast a lot on their forum, and, it was something like where every month I would write something in the show pages or something like that, if that makes any sense, and every month, like, they would recycle it out and post new, forum sections for the specific shows, and the stuff was kind of like, it would be gone pretty much, so I was like, I better save these things that I'm writing, so I started saving them and posting them on my website, and then, you know, after a while, it was kind of like, I think I'm going to turn my website into a paranormal website, because that's really what I'm interested in right now, and then that started, and Chiron sort of joined up with me and started writing his column at Banal of America, and then we found Leslie, and she joined up, and it just sort of turned into a snowball effect. And then as far as the podcast goes, it's sort of like I'd always had an interest in paranormal radio. I enjoy Coast to Coast. I enjoy the Jeff Rentz show. I don't listen to it as much anymore, but I really enjoyed it back before the podcast boom. And so I was kind of like, I'd like to do my own show because, like, I'd like to ask these people questions, and the only way I'd really get a chance to is if I called into Coast to Coast at the end of the show, and I'd really only be able to ask one question, and I don't even know if I'd be able to get on. So it's better if I just figure out my own way to ask them questions. So I did, and started doing my own show, and started with the on-site interviews at the X conference to see if I had if I could do it, pretty much, you know, if the people would be cool about doing interviews and if I could do them. So it was quite an experience to sort of do my first interviews in person and on the fly like that with guys like Stan Friedman and Michael Sala and stuff like that. So it was pretty cool to be able to do that. And then from there, it was once I figured out the technical aspects of doing it, then it was just a matter of, you know, scheduling people and taping the interviews and figuring out how to do it.
Have you found that people are mostly pretty open to the idea of doing the interviews with you?
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah. I was really surprised when I first started doing the show because I sort of made a list of like a dozen people that I definitely wanted to interview who were like pretty big names and stuff like that. And, you know, of the dozen, I'd say six or seven of them appeared during season one. And since then, I'd say 10 total have appeared in season one. There's still like two guests maybe that I can think of off the top of my head that haven't been on the show yet that I still want to get on, and we just haven't had a chance to connect yet. So even the biggest names I've found are really cool about doing interviews and stuff like that. So, and as the show's gotten bigger, now I get people contacting me that want to be on the show. So all the you know, knocking on doors and cold calling people and cold emailing people that I respect and people whose work I enjoy, now I'm getting people contacting me and saying that they want to be on my show. So it's taken a lot of the burden off of me as far as finding guests and stuff like that.
That's a really, really nice thing when it gets to that point. I've had that happen once or twice, and I love it.
Yeah, it's great. It's great.
Like, hey, Rich, somebody called me. They want to be on my show. This is so cool.
Yeah, yeah. The only downside is sometimes I get just too many. Like at the beginning of the summer when we wrapped up season three, and like the last thing I wanted to do was interview anybody. I just wanted to, you know, relax. I got like maybe six emails like in the span of a month of people who wanted to be on the show, and I'd like tell everybody, like, get back to me in August and we'll figure it out then, because I can't.
Yeah.
I can't figure this out yet. I'm overwhelmed.
Yeah. I actually have someone on the message board here who has a question.
Sure.
And I believe he would like to come on with us. So I'm going to turn this over to Joe, my producer, and when Dave can come on, we're going to take a question from a caller.
Awesome. Should I just wait? How does this work?
Yeah, I'm just waiting for him to come through. Wait, I don't get people call in very often. So,
right.
Yes, Dave.
Yeah, I just
with
wanted
us?
To ask if you could tell the future. Because I know there are some psychic people.
I was just wondering, and if you have, like, special sightings of ghosts and how they look like. And do they come from up above through a light, like from heaven? Or do they just appear in a puff of smoke or something like that? So it's just generally a question about how do ghosts appear, and can you tell the future? Okay, and if you can, could you tell my future? If you can, thanks.
Thought-provoking question. I can tell your future right now. You will not get an answer to the question of what your future is, because I have no idea what it is. I'm not psychic or anything like that. The only prediction I'll make is that the Red Sox are going to go all the way this year and win the World Series. But other than that, I have no, and that Barack Obama will win the election. But
and
other
we know
than,
there's a, as far as the Red Sox, at least, we know there's a large element of wishful thinking that may or may not come.
Well, there's a large element in the Barack Obama prediction as well, so. But other than that, I have no predictions, you know, other than the fourth season of Binaural America Audio is going to be great. But no, I don't have any psychic abilities. I've never seen a UFO. I've had one sort of ghostly type experience, but other than that, you know, I have a pretty normal existence here, which is kind of good because, you know, like I had heard Stan Friedman do an interview a long time ago and kind of answered a similar question like this, and he said that he'd never seen a UFO, so I think that you almost don't want to see a UFO if you're in this field, because then you kind of lose a lot of perspective of what's going on, and you become a true believer because you've seen a UFO. So, you know, you're absolutely certain that they exist, but I can't say that because I've never seen one. So,
now that raises two points that are both really odd, which have just been striking me lately, just in the past week, in conversations with other people. And the first is how many people who are UFO researchers who have done this for years. I mean, Stan Friedman's been in this field for more than 30 years. And people who have never seen a UFO but are really, really into this. They really want to know what the truth is about them. And so many people, I think, who are skeptics will always say, oh, you're into this because you've had some experience, you think you saw one.
Yeah,
and it's really not the case so often.
Totally. Well, it's no surprise that the skeptics are getting the information wrong, because that seems to be their part and parcel as far as when it comes to UFOs. But that's an interesting point about ufologists and UFO experiences. That would be an interesting survey, I think, to put together, or sort of an informal straw poll to see really what the percentage is of big-name ufologists or recognized or established ufologists that have seen or have not seen a UFO. Because, you know, I know somebody like Grant Cameron's had a spectacular UFO sighting when he was a kid. So, you know,
yeah, I've heard a lot of people, quite a few researchers have described their experiences and their sightings. But I've also heard quite a few just lately saying, I've never seen one. I'd love to, but I've never seen one. But they're deeply into this. They're doing the research. They're talking to witnesses. They're researching the case reports. So I just find that really fascinating, that people who have never had a personal experience are really delving into this and really gripped by it. The other thing I found really striking about this is that whole concept which you mentioned, that as soon as somebody has a personal experience, as soon as someone has seen it for themselves, it's like they're discredited. Whereas in any other case, if someone witnesses a crime, for example, eyewitness testimony is considered pretty valuable. But in this field, saying you saw it, you were there, you saw what happened, immediately everyone will just say, oh, well, you know, this person thinks they actually saw it, so we can't pay any attention to what he says.
Yeah. I'm not saying that we should discount people's, you know, testimony.
No, I didn't mean you, but I mean skeptics will immediately say, oh, well, you know, as soon as you come out and say, I've seen a UFO, it's like your credibility is gone.
Yeah, but with skeptics, they're playing with loaded dice anyway. I mean, they'll use whatever it takes to discredit what you're saying. So, I mean, that's a big thing that they can use, and that, you know, they'll sort of, like, turn that around to be sort of like they're empathizing with the audience. You know, where they're like, oh, this guy, you know, because they are under the impression that most of the people in the audience haven't seen a UFO. So then they can sort of turn it around, so they're both laughing at the UFO guy. You know,
yeah.
Skeptics are, they're a vile breed. I don't even really, mostly the debunkers. I mean, I have a lot of respect for general skepticism and all that stuff, and I'm pretty skeptical. I'm downright cynical. So, I mean, I'm not someone that believes everything that they hear.
Mm-hmm.
So I can appreciate that, but it's the desperate skepticism, the zealous skepticism that I have no use for.
Well, everyone should be skeptical in the sense of taking every bit of information and saying, is this reasonable? Does this make sense? You know,
yeah.
In light of the rest of the research. So, yeah, I mean, and of course UFO reports often do sound pretty outrageous, but once you've heard the same thing 7, 8, 10, 20 times, it starts to sound less and less outrageous.
Absolutely.
Well, okay. I mean, it's out there, but a lot of people all across the country and around the world have had the same experience. So it begins to sound more reasonable, and you start to weigh everything else against that. But
yeah.
Then there are people who say, oh, that light that changed color and that five police officers chased over three counties and they were radioing back and forth to each other, yeah, that was Venus. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
I mean,
totally.
Come on. I was watching a video once on UFO cases, and my daughter happened to be in the room, and she was, I don't know, 8 or 9 years old. And she wasn't really paying attention and was just on. And it was a case like this where several police officers were chasing something down streets. I mean, people were calling in and saying, I think a plane's going to crash because I'm seeing something really low down my street. And it went across several precincts, and so they're talking to each other about it. And then didn't they get some astronomer on at the end? He said, oh, yeah, the planet Venus looks like that sometime when it's just on the horizon. And the police are saying it changed colors. It was like Christmas tree lights. It was moving. We were driving past it, turning corners.
Wow.
And, you know, my daughter, who's 8 years old, turns around and says, what did he say? I said, come on, you can't even fool an 8-year-old kid who wasn't even paying attention. Now, come on. That's pathetic.
Yeah, yeah. I think they just hope and rely on the idea that once whatever, you know, once the flap is over, once the sighting is over, once the news report that they're a guest on or whatever is over, that people are just going to get on with their lives and you know, I forget who said it, but, you know, a large percentage of the people in America may believe in UFOs, but a very small percentage care.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the difference that ufologists and ufology sort of needs to wrap its head around. You know, trying to prove this thing is sort of like old hat. It's been done, kind of. There's no... I don't think we're going to be able to prove it one way or the other unless the aliens or whoever it is in the UFOs decides to prove it for us. So I think mm-hmm. trying to prove things is not really that important, and maybe getting people to care is more important.
Yeah, I'm finding that a lot in the last year or so among researchers. They're kind of moving on past the whole issue of do UFOs exist. And they're moving on to, okay, they exist, they're here, they're being piloted, you know, there are beings here from wherever. So now let's go to how we're going to deal with them.
Yeah, yeah. But I'm not, also on the other side of the coin, how I was kind of critical of, you know, zealous skeptics. I'm equally, you know, critical of zealous ufologists and zealous UFO people. You know, something, I just sort of, my life sort of changed about a year and a half ago, and I used to get really worked up about the UFO thing and really want the answer to be revealed and would get angry, you know, like over the Fife Symington Phoenix Light story. But then after a while, it was just kind of like, you know, well, obviously, honestly, you know, my father passed away, my life changed, things, you know, changed. And it kind of, you know, the real world, you have to keep one foot in the real world and one foot in the UFO world. And I think when, over that period of my life, I took one foot out of the UFO world and put it back into the real world and kind of, you know, can look at this thing as an intellectual mystery. It's fascinating, it's puzzling, but I'm not going to lose any sleep over it, and I'm not going to get angry about it. And there's too many, way too many people in the paranormal world that are full of vitriol for no reason, and there's no point. This should be fun. That's kind of my attitude about the whole paranormal scene.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, a lot of people take the research very seriously, but at the same time, it is really fun.
Absolutely, yeah. And just like, there's just a lot of anger, it seems, and I don't understand it, really. It's like anger over not knowing the answer, and it's like, and then not knowing who to blame, so then they blame other researchers or other shows or anyone but themselves. And it's like, listen, you know, we're not going to get the answer probably ever, or if we do, you know, it would be great or whatever, but it's out of your hands. There's nothing you can do about it. And you sort of just have to go along for the ride and take it in and don't get upset over stuff that you have no control over, like, you know, whether or not Fife Symington spoke out about UFOs or whatever, or you know, if a host doesn't critique a guest the way you want them to or something.
Yeah, one thing I've really learned in the last few years is you will never, ever, ever please everybody.
That's
and,
the truth.
You know, no matter what you do, somebody's going to get honked off about it. So.
Absolutely. Yeah, so I try not to worry about that kind of thing. And you know, in the course of the last year or so, especially like on my show, you know, and like I said when we did the baseball special, you know, there's a world outside of the paranormal, and I worry about the people that are just, you know, so obsessed with the paranormal that they have a skewed view of the real world, or, you know, it's okay to live in the world of the paranormal, but it's not okay to live of the world of the paranormal. You know, you have to stop and smell the roses and realize that there's other things going on, especially nowadays with the election and the financial crisis and the war. You
know. Yeah, plenty of other stuff going on to worry about. Wow. And on that note, it's actually time to take a break. I can't believe we've gone through the whole first hour so quickly.
I know. We're flying here.
I know. Soon enough, it's going to be time to for you to be starting to try to watch that ball game over your shoulder. Listen to me with one ear. Okay, we're going to go to break now. Thanks for joining us, everyone, so far. You're listening to Through the Keyhole on the Paranormal Radio Network and UPRN 105.3 FM in New Orleans. We're just taking a break, so don't go away too far. When we return, I'll be talking some more with Tim Binall of Binall of America website and podcast. We're going to talk. I'm going to ask some more about the upcoming new season that's going to be starting in a couple of weeks. So don't go away. We will see you right in a few minutes.
Are we off air?
Hi, everyone. Welcome back. You're listening to Through the Keyhole on the Paranormal Radio Network and on UPRN 105.3 FM in New Orleans. I'm your host, Karen Dolan, and my guest today is Tim Binall of Binall of America podcast and website. And, Tim, I know we were talking on the break that before we go any farther, we wanted to mention a couple of guests that you had the chance to interview who have recently passed away.
Yeah, absolutely. I had a weird sort of experience this summer because one of the guests that we had on in Season 2, which we had you on in the beginning of Season 2, and then actually I think I had you on in the beginning of Season 3. Yeah, I did.
Yeah.
A guest we had on in Season 2, towards the end of it, Kent Daniel Benkowski, he passed away over the course of the summer. And it was a really sort of surreal experience for me because I've never had that happen where someone I've interviewed has passed away. So it was weird. It was really weird. Because you think about, and I posted something at Binall of America about it, you know, you always sort of think, well, I'll have them back on again and we'll talk about this later. Or, you know, something will happen and you'll be like, oh, next time I talk to this guy, I'm going to have to ask him. And now, you know, these are threads and avenues of inquiry that are going to die now with the guest. So it's very sad. And Kent was a great guy. And
what was his field?
He was into the parapolitics, and actually, and it's really sad because I think he would have been a great guest for your show because he was looking into a lot of conspiracy messages hidden in Disney films.
Oh, I would have loved to talk to him.
Yeah. So he had just started really looking into that when I interviewed him, and yeah, I could tell by the time we were done with, I think it was a 2-hour interview, and I think we spent the second hour just talking about messages hidden in films like that, and you could tell that he was really on the cusp of a huge new avenue of research, and that you know, 5 years or something down the line, or a few years down the line, that he was going to have just a massive amount of stuff on that topic. So that was really heartbreaking when he passed away, because I knew that we lost a lot of great research that was going to come out of that.
Yeah. Had he published anything? Any of
He has a blog. He had a blog, Kentroversy. You can find all that through Binall of America if you go to the Season 2 archive, or, I don't know, just do a search for Kent. Chances are there's very few mentions of Kent other than the Kent mentioned on the interview page for Kent. It's like a tongue twister. But yeah, so it was weird. It was just really sad and unfortunate and depressing, really, in a sense, because, you know, like I said, you just think about all these questions that, because he was really passionately believing that the election here in 2008 was already predetermined and that Hillary Clinton was going to be the next president, and I mean, he was really passionate about that, and I really was looking forward to having him on the show, not to not to like be obnoxious and be like, well, you got it wrong, you know, that kind of thing, but to be like, what happened here, you know, what do you think, you know, within the framework of your research, you know, why did things go so far awry of what you thought was going to happen? And you know, I'll never know that. I mean, I'm sure he may have done other interviews and other shows, and I know he was a regular on the Red Ice Creations program, so maybe he delved into that on those shows. But you know, for me personally, I'll never know the answers to those questions unless he did answer them and I dig them up somewhere else. Which, given the amount of free time I have right now, is unlikely to happen anytime soon. So it was really unfortunate and sad, and he's definitely missed by me and a lot of the people on the blogosphere. Like I said, he had the blog Kentroversy, and it was really popular, and a lot of the online folks were big fans and friends of his. I know Leslie, who writes for our site, was a good friend of his. So, you know, it was really unfortunate passing. Mm. Yeah.
A
downer.
I'm glad that you told me about him. I'm really sorry that I never heard of this man until after it became too late to talk to him about his research, because it is something I'm really interested in.
And, yeah.
I'll definitely have to look up, I'll have to listen to that interview that you did with him and look up his blog.
Yeah, definitely check out the second hour, because that's when we really get into a lot of that stuff. And, And like I said, it was just sort of weird. It's just, you know, I'm a young guy, I'm only like 30, and I've only known maybe like five or six people that have died anyway. So to have interviewed someone, and it's always different when you interview someone than when you listen to the show, because there's a lot of downtime, like, you know, like how we were, excuse me, I'm all blurry here. Like how you and I and Joe were sort of chewing the fat here during the break, you know, there's moments like that are, you know, standalone moments that no one else has that are on a personal level that you remember. Like when I taped the interview with Kent, we had some technical problems taping the show, and one of the wires was messed up or something. And the gist of it is, we taped a half hour and it had all gone wrong and pretty much, and the sound was gone and everything, and we had to start all over again and tape that first half hour all over again. And he was really, really cool about it. And, you know, it was a terribly embarrassing situation for me, but he was just really cool about it, and I'll never forget just how easygoing he was about it and how seamlessly we just started the program, like, all over again after a half hour.
Well, that's partly because you're so organized and in control, too. I mean, you have your questions worked out ahead of time, and I would have a terrible time with something like that because I do everything off the cuff.
Yeah. Yeah, I can imagine.
Forget what we talked about.
Yeah, well, there have been situations where, like, you know, I'll be taping the show and someone here in my house will pick up the phone and start dialing, and it'll.
Oh, I've had that happen on a live show.
Well, I disconnected all the phones tonight except for this one, because I knew I'd be doing the interview and I knew we'd be live, so I didn't want that to happen.
Yeah, I have to take all the cordless handsets with me when I lock myself in this one room to do the show, because I've had other people go up and just take another handset without thinking and go to make a call.
Oh, totally, totally.
You
know,
you've got to just pick everything up and take them in here.
Yeah. And, so we're going to be, you know, like I said, in the break and everything, I'm really glad we got a chance here to talk about Kent, and we're going to talk a little bit, I hope, about Monsignor Corrado Balducci, who passed away a couple weeks ago. And it's great that I get a chance to talk about it here with you, because, you know, we're going to be dedicating the season premiere to Kent and Monsignor Balducci, but I don't know how much I'm really going to talk about that at the beginning of the show, other than just dedicating the season premiere to them. So I'm glad we got a chance here to talk about it on your show, so folks can hear what I think about all that.
Yeah. Do you know how Kent Benkowski died?
All I know is that he was pretty sick.
He had been ill before?
Yeah, he had been in deteriorating health at the beginning of the summer. And he passed away, I think, in late July or something like that.
Yeah.
It's always sort of, that's the weird part about it, too, because the same sort of thing happened with Corrado Balducci, who passed away. He passed away on September 20th, but word didn't get out to the paranormal scene until October 3rd, which is like nearly, like over 2 weeks away, or almost 2 weeks away or something. So, and that sort of thing happened with Kent, too, where he passed away, and then word didn't get out really till, you know, a couple weeks later. So it's kind of weird. So if I disappear for a while, don't get too nervous, folks. But yeah, and I was really sad about the passing of Corrado Belducci, because he had been the first. There's sort of like three first interviews for me. The first phone interview with Jim Mars, the first on-site interview, which was like 6 months or 4 months earlier with Stan Friedman, and then just my straight-up first interview ever, which was with Corrado Belducci and Paula Harris when I was at the X conference. So it was really sad for me, because he was such an esteemed legend and such a huge interview and opportunity for me. For that to be my first interview was just mind-blowing, and I'm forever grateful to Paula Harris for letting me in on that whole scene and letting me be a part of that interview. That it was really sad for me to see him go, because he was quite a character and quite a voice about the UFO phenomenon and about demonology and stuff like that, and just an amazing guy. I don't know, were you and Rich at that X conference when he spoke, or no?
Yeah, I was just going to ask whether that was where you got to meet him first as well, because, I remember that one very well. That was an amazing event that she was able to bring him over.
Yeah, it was quite an event, and like I said, and it was just amazing for me because, you know, I was only probably like 26, 27 at the time. It had to be like 26, maybe even 25, and I had never done an interview or anything, and a friend of mine who was at the conference, Frank Knies, who's a great guy, but he's like the Tasmanian devil. He's just like a whirlwind with arms sticking out of it. And I had never done an interview before. I had been sort of saying that I'd like to do interviews. And next thing I knew,
he said, "Oh, why don't you go talk to this man who doesn't speak English?"
it was more nerve-wracking than that, because just came up to me in the middle of the conference and said, "We're interviewing Belducci in a half hour," or something like that. It was not even like, "Would you like to?" It was like, "I've gotten you in, we're doing this," and it was like, "What? This is amazing." You know,
wow.
I'm in way over my head. So,
wow.
Yeah. And it was an experience I'll never forget, and so to be able to do that, and the Monsignor was, I remember after the interview was over, I was shaking hands with him, and he said to me, "Oh, you're so young," and it was just like really just an amazing experience, because he was so esteemed and held in such high regard by everybody at the conference that just to even be able to know first, just to be able to interview him and have him even, you know who I am or take note of me was just amazing, and so it was humbling.
Yeah,
and
he had such a lot of personality, too. He was such a great...
Absolutely, yeah.
It was such an amazing experience getting to meet him.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, we're going to dedicate the season premiere to those two guys, and they're very far apart, really, as far as what their research was. You know, Kent was very... micro-oriented, very detail-oriented on the really small sort of details, and the Monsignor was really very vast and macro-oriented about the big picture sort of stuff. So it was sort of like two different ends of the spectrum, but they were both great guys, and it was really just strange and sad to see them go. So and as an interviewer, it's something I've never experienced, and unfortunately something that I'll experience again, I'm sure, in the future. So
stay in the field long enough. Now, someone was asking on the message board a little while ago how long you see yourself staying in this, you know, continuing to do podcasts, or are you projecting your career to go in a different direction at some point?
I don't really even know, you know. I was kind
this
of getting
like one of those job interview questions. Where do you see yourself in 5 years?
Well, we're in luck because I have thought about it. So.
Oh, good.
You know, I got kind of disenfranchised with the whole scene. Sort of like back, like I said, when my father passed away and the real world sort of reared its ugly head on me and sort of got back picked myself up by my bootstraps and went rolling on with season three. But sort of toward the end of season three or three quarters of the way through, I was just kind of like, it was starting to wear on me. A lot of the negativity online really was kind of wearing on me.
What do you mean by the negativity online?
Just, it seems like there's a lot of like critics and stuff like that, and people that I have no problem with people that have critiques of the show and stuff like that, and but I have a problem with the vitriolic critiques and people who just don't write to me straight up. You know what I mean? If someone has a problem with the way I do my show, I'd be happy if they wrote to me and said it, but it seems like a lot of times you find them emailing other people about it, and then you hear about it secondhand or something like that, and it's just like, I don't need this crap, you know? I'm putting on a show for free. I'm not really, all I'm asking for is for donations. I'm not strong-arming anyone to give me money or anything like that. I'm not selling anything. I don't understand, like, if you don't like my show, don't listen to it, that's cool, or if you think I should do something differently, email me about it and let me know. But, you know, don't post on a blog somewhere or email someone else about it, where I'm not even going to know what what your critique is. So it
I've never understood people who do that, who post, you know, they'll listen to a show week after week and then post someplace everything they hate about it.
Exactly.
Like, why are you wasting your time listening to this if you don't like it?
Yeah, and anybody who's written to me, who listens to the show and who's written to me, can attest that I answer like 90% of the emails. I mean, I've even written people back like a month after they've written to me saying, hey, I'm really sorry I haven't got a chance to write back to you, but here's what I think about X or whatever, you know. So it's like, you know, I'm very accessible. I have my own forum. I have my own email address, all that stuff, you know, and so it's just disheartening when you see that kind of thing. So it was sort of like, what's the point? What am I doing this for? But, you know, at the end of the day, I enjoy doing the show. So I don't foresee any, you know, I don't foresee me just dropping things out of all of a sudden. Do you know what I mean? But then there also, you have to take into account, just the present state of the economy and the way the world is right now. And, you know, I'm looking for a full-time job. I have a pretty decent gig right now going on, but it's certainly not enough to, pay the bills. So I'm sort of just getting by like month to month right now. And, you know, I've been pretty honest with people that if I got a really good job offer from some place and they said, you know, well, you can't run your website anymore, then, you know, at the end of the day, critical praise for the podcast doesn't put food on my table. And you know,
funny about groceries and electricity and stuff.
Yeah. When my college
loans come due. The kids get all testy if there's no food on the table, you know.
Yeah. I can't say, hey, you know, I don't have the money to pay for my car payments, but is it okay if I send you this glowing email from someone who said I put together a really great free podcast?
Yeah.
It's like, it doesn't work that way. And so, you know, I have to be a realist about it.
We're in the UFO field, and we do this for the money, right?
Oh, absolutely,
Isn't that why everybody gets into UFOs? We all want to tell our stories for the money?
Oh, totally, yeah. I'm just rolling in it here.
That's my favorite thing I hear skeptics say.
But
What money?
I figure I'll be doing the show. I'm kind of like one of those people that once I start something, I have to finish it. So I foresee, unless there's some drastic change, since we're starting season 4 next weekend, season 4 will go all the way through to 31 episodes or however many we usually do, 30 or so. And then I have sort of an idea for a theme of what I want to do for season 5, if we can get there. And then all bets are off after that. I mean, lately I've been kind of thinking that I'd kind of like to pull a Lost and decide on an end date like a year and a half in advance and say, you know what, you know, we're going to wrap up in All of America Audio when season 5 ends, and we're telling you right now in the middle of season 4. So you got another year and a half of this show, and that's it. But that would require some sort of assurance that I'd be financially stable for like the next couple of years, and nobody has that assurance right now. So
yeah.
I don't expect that to happen, but you know, I think when the podcast wraps up, I'll probably have it known in advance, you know, at least 6 months or something. So because I kind of envy the way that the people who do Lost did it, and like I said, I do my own show, and it's sort of like it's a TV show, so that would be kind of my attitude about the show. I'd say, you know, the finale of the show, the series finale will be, you know, this time. So but I really
get some kind of conclusion.
Oh yeah.
You know?
Well, I'm already kind of thinking about that. I do have, you know, sort of an idea of who the final guest of the whole show will be, and so now, like I said, it's just a matter of getting there and whether or not it would work out that way. But I mean, that's really far far off and in the deep, thick ether of my mind, pretty much, of the sort of things I contemplate when I'm lying in bed at night. You know, if I end the program, how will it end, and who will it end with, and, you know, what is the road I'll take to actually ending the show? But like I said, I have a really cool idea and theme for what season 5 will be, if we can get there. So I kind of want to get to season 5, and I kind of want to produce season 5 because of, you know, what I've been thinking about doing for season 5. And then, you know, from there, who knows? It's hard to even plan the show, you know, 6 weeks in advance. So to plan it 2 years in advance is really is quite a thing. But rest assured, I do think that far in advance as far as the program goes.
Yeah. I'm sorry, I'm checking the message board here because there was another question someone had asked, and I was just trying to find it. People have gone on talking, and there's a really good conversation going on here.
I will add in also that, now I'm losing my train of thought.
Oh, is this because baseball games started, see?
Well, it hasn't started yet. They're on a commercial.
Oh, okay, good.
I just rolled my chair over to look. But you know, in some ways I feel like I'm kind of under the burden of the paranormal world too. You know, I'm young. I'm not someone who's retired or who has a really steady career with tenure where they're not too worried about losing their job or something like that, or, you know, that kind of thing.
Well, somebody with tenure has to worry even more about this sort of thing.
Yes, that's true. But so I'm not really so I'm kind of like in the position where I'd like to start a career. You know, I'm getting older and the real world's pulling on me, and my youthful days are sort of falling by the wayside. So I'm at a weird crossroads in my life, and I've joked that it took me about 3 years to get into this paranormal field, so it's probably going to take me about 3 years to get out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I said that joke about a year ago, so it's all kind of lining up that 2 years... that I may only have 2 years left, but who knows? I mean, I could also see a situation where, you know, we wrap up in All of America Audio season 5 and we launch into some whole new venture, you know, maybe a book or, you know, maybe a TV series or maybe like an internet video thing or something like that. But I can't imagine I'd do two things at once. So if some exciting new project came along, you know, it might be time to evolve. I have the message here on my forum here. My signature is, an artist has got to be constantly in a state of becoming, and that's Bob Dylan, and that's kind of how I live. You know, I'm always trying to become something different. I'm always trying to evolve into something new. So maybe sometime with this podcast boom, you know, the novelty of having a podcast may not be all that anymore, and it may be time to try and do something that'll set BOA apart from all the other shows and all the other websites. So who knows? Mm-hmm. Who knows what's going to happen?
Yeah. Now, I've got a couple people on the message board here who want to know what you think of Steve Bassett's new project, this Million Facts on Washington. Have you heard about that?
Oh, yeah, I've heard about it. I think it's interesting. I like Steve. He's really cool. Like I said, I kind of cut my teeth at the X Conference, the first one and the second one. The first one I was there as a bystander, as a citizen, you know, just a plebeian. So I didn't really, no one knew who I was. I knew who most of the speakers are and stuff like that, but I was just a regular person in the crowd. And then the second year, I was writing for Coast to Coast AM's magazine and doing my own interviews, and that's where I did the Balducci interview and the Dan Friedman one and the Sala one, all the other ones there. So it's always sort of been interesting and kind of held a place in my heart, the X Conference and Steve Bassett and everything. I used to be a real proponent for exopolitics, but sort of like back when I stopped taking this too seriously and stopped getting too worked up about it, I kind of sort of pulled back on that just as I became more cynical about the UFO secret. I've been interested in this for like 5 years now, and it seems like every year it's always right around the corner, and, you know, after a while you get kind of like cynical about it and you say, you know, this is tiring. I don't know when. I'm tired of waiting. I'm tired of being disappointed. So you sort of stop investing in wanting it to happen. But as far as the whole the new project and everything, I kind of like, it's an interesting idea, the facts on Washington, and I'll be interested to see if anything comes of it.
Yeah, I think it's a very cool idea, you know, and it's something that a lot of people can really get involved in easily. You know, it's a simple thing that we can do, and with a new president coming in, I think we really do have a chance at making a difference. You know, it'll be interesting to see what kind of response we can get and how many people actually do send in letters.
Totally, totally. But I think also at this point, I'd rather if the president just fixed the economy than than give out the UFO secret, because he could come out and say UFOs are real, but my dollar would still be worthless.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd like to prioritize what the next president will do. But I'm all for pressuring the government and trying to get answers and stuff. In a way. I have a detached whole point of view from the whole thing. I feel kind of like a journalist about it. I cheer for the story. So, if disclosure happened, I'd be all about it. It'd be great.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see. And you know, I was talking with Steve a week or so ago on the show. In fact, last week I think we were talking. I have been good and pre-recorded an interview since then. So it,
awesome.
It just threw off my whole schedule. I have no idea what day it is anymore. but I did talk with Steve recently about this project, and we realized while we were talking that the 5th of November is the day after the election. That's the day it's all starting. And so we were talking about V for Vendetta, you know, remember the 5th of November. I said, oh, everybody's got to watch V for Vendetta and have their letter-writing parties that day then.
Yeah, it's cool. And like you said, it's a great idea. I mean, I'm all for activism and stuff like that, and it's a good way for people to get involved without having to drive to Washington or something, or, you know, march on Washington, and hopefully it'll do something, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, I've been surprised in the last year about just how much I feel like things are. Now, I'm kind of like going against exactly what I said earlier, like about being cynical and being tired of waiting for the answer and all that, but I do feel like we're turning a corner here. But it's such a slow process and such a slow turn that, you know, we may be going through the we're turning the corner period for five more years. Do you know what I mean? It might not be a year long we're turning the corner and the answer will be at the end of the year. It might be we're turning the corner and the answer will be in 2020 or something. You know, we don't know. But it feels like with the increased media coverage of UFOs, the whole Kucinich UFO thing, the international UFO document releases that seem to be going on quite a bit now.
Yeah, that's happening a lot, like all over the world now.
Absolutely,
and
I feel
more
like
and more coming out.
I feel like maybe things are changing for the better, but who knows?
What do you think about this? The channeled information about the big UFO appearance that's supposed to be coming next week on the 14th.
I've heard about it, but
yeah.
As soon as I found out it was some kind of channeled information, I didn't even investigate it too much. You know, I just don't take that sort of thing seriously, and anytime there's sort of a date affixed to something, I'm almost always sort of poo-poo it, because that seems to be the precursor to a disappointing turn of events.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd advise people not to get their hopes up too much that anything's going to happen, and you know, don't max out your credit cards.
Yeah.
Because you think the UFO secret is going to be revealed.
Yeah, don't do this end of the world thing, but it'll be interesting to see if there are any major sightings that day.
Totally, absolutely. And then, you know, you can take the cynical point of view that if there are, is it because everyone was looking?
Yeah. Well, I guess one of the channelers said, at least one said, maybe more than one agreed on this, that the UFOs had promised to appear and to remain visible for 72 hours.
Oh, wow.
So there won't be any question about whether they're there. You'll have plenty of opportunity to take pictures. And, you know, I find this really interesting because for years, in discussing the question of disclosure, I've always felt that we can do whatever we want. We can say whatever we want. Disclosure really will happen when they want it.
Absolutely.
You know, when whoever's flying the UFOs wants to come out and actually appear in public to large groups of people, which, okay, they have done this before, but, you know, they've tried over O'Hare, and they've tried in Stevensville, and it just seemed like there are still ways that if whoever's flying these things really wants this to get out, if they want to stop hiding, they'll come out and appear to us, and it'll be all over.
Yeah, yeah. That's why I think that, you know, with the whole pressure of the government thing, I don't know if it's really, if it's a futile task. I don't know if it is a situation where even if they wanted to release the information, they couldn't because of some kind of, you know, situation. You know, maybe it's as bad as people fear. Maybe, you know, maybe we are alien food, or maybe, you know, maybe they're planning on interbreeding with people and you know, repopulating the Earth with a hybrid race, or maybe it's all government UFO stuff that they created on their own. That's why they don't want to say anything, you know. It's sort of like, I feel like it's the decision of releasing the information is probably out of the government's hands, and I'd be really interested in finding out how much they know about UFOs at all, if they really know as much as some people think they do, or if they don't know much at all and are just telling people, or just sort of propagating the idea that they don't know, that they know so much, because it gives the government an aura of power that, that, you know, doesn't really exist.
Yeah, well, I believe the government, this big, you know, single entity, and it sounds so funny to say it that way, but I think there has been a lot of information hidden for a very long time, and I do believe that people in our government could release what information they have. I don't think they're going to, personally, until their hand is forced somehow. And, you know, these UFOs appearing and hanging there for 72 hours might be just what we need to force it. Or a million faxes and letters sent to Washington might also be the thing that we need to force the issue.
I don't know.
Interesting to see what happens.
It will be interesting, but I like we both kind of said, I think it's out of the government's hands, and you know, maybe the million facts thing will, it could help in some way that we don't think that it will be. You know what I mean? Instead of some kind of disclosure, maybe then it'll just sort of grease the wheels for, you know, some kind of release of documents somewhere else or something. You know what I mean? It may have a butterfly effect that we don't know about.
Yeah. So, Tim, what else have you been working on? What do you, you do a lot of writing, I know, on your website, and also you write for the After Dark newsletter, Coast to Coast.
Yeah. Well, I do. I haven't written as much as I used to at the website. Once the audio show really became like the full-time amount of work that I do as far as online stuff, then specific writing kind of fell by the wayside, so just a matter of time, really. But I do, on occasion, write for the Coast to Coast newsletter, and they're just publishing a new piece that is in the newest issue. I went to a haunted house out in San Diego. It's a well-known tourist attraction called the Whaley House.
Oh, I've heard of that. I've never been there.
It's pretty cool. It's pretty neat. And since I was staying at my brother's place for a couple of weeks out in San Diego this summer, and he lives about a quarter mile away from there, so it was sort of like within walking distance, and I had the opportunity just to go there whenever I wanted, so I went like four times pretty much, and tried to hang out with the people that are the tour guides and stuff like that. So when people read the article, that's really what it'll be sort of centered around, you know, who are these people that work there, what are their experiences like, because, you know, they're there, you know, four times a week or something, 52 weeks a year, so chances are they've had the best experiences, you know, so... That's the kind of thing I explored in the article, because I didn't want to do just your cookie cutter, you know, it's a haunted house thing. Here's the story behind the haunted house, and, you know, here's the most famous ghost story. It was more like, why are you working here? And how did you end up working at a haunted house? And, you know, what do your friends say about this? And that kind of thing. So it was tried to do a little more personality-driven. But,
did
you
see anything while you were there?
Mm-mm. No, I think, like I said, I've only had one sort of ghostly experience, and other than that, I've had a pretty normal life, and I didn't experience anything at the haunted house, which is kind of disappointing, but at the same time, like we've said, it was probably good, because then the article would have probably just turned into me recounting my ghost story.
Going,
yeah. So, but I've, that's the newest piece, and that'll be in the October issue of After Dark, and then, what did I write before that?
Yeah, you also wrote, you explored Oak Island and the Bridgewater Triangle. Now, I've heard of Oak Island, but I've never heard of the Bridgewater Triangle.
Well, the Bridgewater Triangle is a swath of land in southeastern Massachusetts. It's sort of, it's called the Bridgewater Triangle based on Lauren Coleman. He's the one that coined the term, and it's just sort of a stretch of land in Massachusetts that is home of all different sorts of sightings. Like, you just run the gamut: UFOs, Bigfoot, Big Cat, Thunderbirds, everything under the sun, and then a whole mess of what's that?
I'm sorry. It sounds like the Skinwalker Ranch out in Utah.
Totally. Yeah, it's got total Skinwalker elements to it, and then a whole underlying thing of cults and stuff. Like it's like really breeds a lot of weird cult activity. And I should mention that we had a guest on in season 3, Chris Balzano, Balzano, who ironically enough lived about a half mile away from me. He since has moved, but he became a good friend of mine, and he is a good friend. And we had him on the show last year, and he wrote a really big book about the Bridgewater Triangle and the Freetown State Forest, which is a big part of the Bridgewater Triangle, and talking about all kinds of weird stuff, zombies, weird little sort of mini Bigfoots or something, some kind of like Ewokish looking troll things called Puckwudgies, just crazy stuff going on in the Bridgewater Triangle. And that was like my first experience getting off the armchair and getting into the field, and it was weird and sort of gave me a whole new perspective on what that's like, because, you know, we went down a dirt road and Chris tried to do a three-point turn, and we ended up going over the edge of the dirt road and got the car stuck, and we're sitting there for like an hour and a half and waiting for the tow truck in a massive field where there were like Bigfoot reports and stuff, and I was just like, this is spooky and weird and also very boring, and I never see this stuff on Ghost Hunters, so yeah. It was sort of like, this is what it's really like. It's a lot of downtime and accidents happening and weird things, you know, going awry that you didn't expect, so it was pretty weird.
I always think that when I, on the rare occasions when I do watch one of these paranormal investigation shows, because we don't have cable TV at home, so if I do watch it, it's like at a friend's house or at my parents or something.
Yeah.
And I'm always thinking, gosh, you know, for this footage that they got for this one-hour show, and you figure it's, what, 42 minutes or something when you take out for commercials, I wonder how many hours they had to be there filming to get the usable stuff, because there has to be so much time when you're walking through a haunted house and nothing happens.
Totally, yeah, yeah. This, I think it's like 90% downtime. I'm sure that, well, we had Larry Flaxman on, and actually I'm joined up with Larry's Arkansas Paranormal, I forget the whole wordage of the name of his group, but let me see here. But yeah, I had him on the show, and he's all about the scientific aspects of that whole research. So we talked a lot about that, about, you know, the weirdness of how much downtime there is. Arkansas Paranormal and Anomalous Studies Team, ARPAST, and I'm a consultant for them. I'm not sure what a consultant does yet, but so far I've just written my bio for his website, so
okay.
But I'm consulting, so but so that's pretty
cool. So wait
cool.
And see what they ask you to do, huh?
I know. As long as I don't have to study any paranormal or anomalous things, I'll be all set.
Oh, boy.
But yeah, and I'll probably just mention also here the Oak Island exploration. Really a great time. I went up there and met up with Paul Kimball, who's been on BOA Audio numerous times. And
yeah, now, where is Oak Island again? I mean, I have a vague idea, but there may be people listening who haven't heard of it.
It's part of Nova Scotia, I believe.
So it's
yes.
On the East Coast.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I have family up in Canada, in Prince Edward Island. And
I never would have guessed that from your voice.
Are you being sarcastic or serious?
Yeah. People have been telling me lately that I have a Canadian accent, too, which I think is really funny.
People always seem to think I'm English somehow, and I've never gotten that. And I've been hearing that, like, since I was in college. People would say, I thought you were English. And I was like, what are you talking about? I'm from Boston.
No, but you sound so Canadian to me.
Wow.
And yeah.
But, yeah, so it's an island off of Nova Scotia. Well, there's numerous islands there off of Nova Scotia, tiny little islands. And apparently there's a long-standing rumor and urban legend, I guess, that somebody buried a bunch of gold there, and they've been trying to dig it out now for like 200 years, and every time they get to like a certain point, it fills up with water again, and it's gone. The ownership of the island has changed hands like maybe a dozen times, where people, you know, just invest millions of dollars into trying to dig up the treasure, and then they go bust, and then, you know, someone else comes along 15, 20 years later and buys the island, and the whole thing repeats itself. So, and I'll do another shout-out here. We had Danny Hanegar on right after you were on Been All of America last season, and we do a whole hour and a half on Oak Island, so people can check that out. And it's a fascinating story, and the cool part about going to Oak Island last summer was that they have new owners now, and the island's closed to the public except for one weekend a year, so it's like a really rare and obscure opportunity to check out the island and stuff. So it was pretty cool to be able to do that and go somewhere where otherwise, if it was a different weekend of the year, you wouldn't be able to go there, and you know, only maybe 200 people were there that weekend, so it's like only 200 people all year are going to be able to go to the island. So to be able to be one of those people is pretty neat.
Yeah. That just sounds really amazing, to have been able to be there. Gosh. And speaking of going places, you're going to be at a conference next weekend, right?
Yes, I will be.
In Massachusetts?
Yes, I am. I will be at the Mass UFO Show / Mass Monster Mash. It's a two-day event. You can find out more about it at ufoshow.org and massmonstermash.org, or just go to Been All of America and you'll see the there's a little rotating animation thing that has the posters for it, and I'm actually on the poster, which is kind of surprising. Don't expect me to do anything, folks. I'll just be there, but you know, somehow I'm on the poster.
My next question was going to be, so what are you speaking about, or
I
what
know.
Are you doing?
Well, you know, I, despite what my mother says, I don't think I'm quite poster worthy. So I'm not sure. I'm not sure how I ended up on the poster, but I am, and I'll be there. And who else is going to be there? Lauren Coleman, Nick Redfern, Bud Hopkins, Jeff Bellinger, Leslie Keene, Don Gordon. It's a very intimate feel. It's at Hibernian Hall in Watertown, Mass. And it's really cool. It's only about, I think, maybe 300 people max or something like that. It's a very small building. It's very intimate. It's only $25 to go for each night, so $50 if you were going to go both nights. And as I was telling you off air, Nick Redfern's going to be crashing at Been All of America headquarters next weekend. So it's really, I'm very excited, obviously, about the conference and stuff, but I'm even equally excited about just hanging out with Nick here at my house and stuff for the weekend, and you know, throwing
That's
back a few
be
beers
fun.
And trying to explain to him how important it is that the Red Sox win the baseball game. Watching.
You'll have to record some of that, because that would just be, there's so many people who would love to be a fly on the wall for that.
Oh, totally, yeah. Well, we'll be doing, I'll be doing on-site interviews for that, and that'll be a part of Been All of America Audio Season 4. We did a special last year with on-site interviews, and I'll be doing them this year, too. So it'll be a good time. And as I talked about last year and joked about with Lauren, the cool part, too, about the thing, and I'm hoping that it'll be the case again this year, and I hate to keep beating on the baseball drum, but I will. And that's they have a little green room at the conference where the speakers kind of hang out. And Lauren is, what's up? I'm hearing noises.
I heard something too, but I'm not sure what that was.
Weird. And Lauren's a diehard Red Sox fan like me, and so him and I were sort of huddled in the green room watching, you know, a 10-inch TV, trying to find out the score of the Red Sox game throughout the whole weekend. And you know, he'd be out at his table signing books and stuff, and I'd come out there and be like, you know, Big Poppy just hit a 3-run home run, and he'd be like, I'll be right in. So it was really cool, and sort of like got a chance to hang out with some of the speakers and stuff on a personal level. But yeah, that's next weekend, Mass Monster Mash, Mass UFO Show. It's the biggest show it's the biggest conference in Massachusetts. Definitely something people who are in the New England area should definitely check out. Like I said, it's a very intimate feel. You're going to be able to talk to and hang out with the speakers, and it's a great time. I had a really good time last year, and I'm looking forward to being there this year, and I'm not just saying that because I'm on the poster.
It sounds like a lot of fun. I've got your website up, and I'm trying to read the poster. As it keeps cycling through, I have to grab it for a couple of seconds and, you know, try to read this. The topics look pretty cool.
Yeah.
Mothman, Loch Ness Monster, alien abductions. I'm waiting for it to come around again.
Oh boy,
Men in Black, British Bigfoot.
Oh yeah, it's gonna be. They do all kinds of great stuff for that, and you know, it's just fast and loose, and the guy who runs it, John Horgan, he's a good guy. Here's the list here: Mothman, Weird Massachusetts, Haunted Baseball.
Haunted Baseball. I was just going to say, is that what that says?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, what is that all about? Do you know?
Well, one of the speakers is Dan Gordon, and he co-wrote a book, Haunted Baseball, so I presume he'll be the one talking about that, unless they drag me up there to talk about it. So he'll be talking about that, and I haven't had a chance to talk to him yet or even read the book or anything, but he's someone who's sort of on the future BOA audio wish list for guests, so I'll probably be rubbing elbows with him and talking to him about the book and stuff and trying to set up a future interview with him. But it's a lot of fun. There's cool exhibits and stuff in the back of the conference hall, and neat souvenirs and stuff. And John Horgan, who runs the conference, he does a lot of work with the Bruins and the Patriots and the Celtics and stuff. So usually there's I know last year there was some autographed stuff that was going out as part of some, you know, people bought numbers or something like that, some kind of blind drawing or something, and people won cool autographed stuff. So, and then, you know, trivia contest and stuff like that. So it's fast and it's loose, and then there's some great speakers and presentations and stuff. So it's pretty cool. If people haven't been to a conference before, it's definitely one they're going to want to check out. And like I said, only $25. That's pretty good for a conference.
Yeah, a lot of them are more expensive than that. And this is going to be where, in Massachusetts?
Yep, it's going to be in Watertown, Mass, which is just outside of Boston. It's probably about 5 minutes from my house, so it's good for me. I mean, you know, I enjoy going to conferences, but the fact that one's 5 minutes away from my house is just a super bonus. Do you know what I mean? Because, I mean, you and I met at the Crash Retrieval Conference in Vegas, and I had an awesome time, but it's like, it's a whole to-do to fly out to Vegas and, you know, stay in the hotel, and then, you know, I have like a weird situation where, you know, I want to go see stuff, but I don't have the time, or I don't feel like it, and I think I should, and it's like, I don't feel like going down to the Strip, but I'm here in Vegas, and I should, so it's like, I have to drag myself out to go see, you know, Caesar's Palace or whatever, so so it's like, I'd rather just go to the conference, hang out, go home and relax, and then go back the next day. So that's pretty cool that I can do that here for the Mass Monster Mash, and you know, it's pretty neat that they treat me amazingly well there too. Like I said, they put me on the poster.
Nice.
And it's not like, you know, I didn't say I'm coming to the conference, I better be on the poster. It was like last year I went and they gave me a big plaque for my contributions to the UFO field, so that was pretty neat. I mean, they really they like me over there, so they must not know me too well. I don't know. So
well,
that'll be
enjoy
cool.
Enjoy it when you get back over there. Tim, we are out of time. I can't believe this. I just had a great time talking with you. Thank you so much for coming on the show tonight. And I'm really looking forward to hearing your new season starting up in a couple of weeks.
Well, thanks. I appreciate you having me on the show, and I hope people definitely want to check out Banal of America Audio Season 4. It starts next weekend, of course. That's actually, you're kind of asking about the about why on Sunday. That's, you know, I had thought about doing the 18th, but then I knew I was going to be doing the going to the Mass conference, so
right.
I was like, I better put it on
the
19th.
Conference, and when you get back, you'll be posting that first.
Totally,
first
and we're
going to
have. Let me just run down some of the other stuff we'll have for that. I know Jim Marr is on the 19th. Then we're going to have Dr. Stephen Rourke talking about the Spiracom story. Weird device that supposedly could channel people who had passed away and stuff, and he's done a thorough job looking into it and sort of debunking that story. So we're going to get him to lay out the full evidence for why the Spiracom story wasn't what we think it is. And then let me see here. And then Adam Davies talking about some of his cryptozoological expeditions all around the world. That'll be the weekend after that. And then Charles Upton talking about metaphysical UFO theories. So those are some of the guests we'll have coming up. And then I'm also working on a BOA Audio spinoff series that I should have mentioned earlier, and that's going to be with the staff of Banal of America. Shortcut interviews with people like Leslie Chiron, Richard Thomas from Wales, Regan Lee, and so we're going to have a spinoff series coming up probably a couple weeks after the debut of Season 4.
Cool. Well, that
sounds
great.
So we've got a lot on the plate, yeah.
And we should mention, too, that as of tonight, Banal of America will soon be in syndication on the Paranormal Radio Network as well.
Absolutely, yeah. We talked to Joe about that before the show started, so keep an eye out for BOA Audio on, what's the name of the network again?
Paranormal Radio Network.
Pretty simple. I'll have to remember that. I'll do my best.
And Joe says it already is. It's already here.
Awesome.
Wow,
it's already on the
service.
Paranormal Radio Network.
Believe
See
it.
How things work so fast. Joe's great. I hope he's doing better after his little scare a couple weeks ago. He's a good friend of Melinda Leslie. I'm a good friend of Melinda, so he's the man. And I've met him a few times at the conferences. Very impressed with his professionalism and his ambition. So we need more people like Joe in the field for sure.
Absolutely. And we are completely out of time now, Tim. Thanks so much. And thanks, everyone, for listening. This has been Through the Keyhole live on the Paranormal Radio Network and on UPRN 105.3 FM in New Orleans. Archives are available at paranormalradionetwork.org, on iTunes, and now also at blackvaultradio.com. I'm your host, Karen Dolan, and stay tuned for Portal up next with Tuesday Miles and Angela Thomas. Thanks, everyone. See you next week.
Are we off?